big city superintendent had served in any city in the country running an educational system. And Secretary Duncan, it's fair to say, had become a star in educational circles. When you look at some of the things that he did during the time that you ran the Chicago schools, the schools had a record number of elementary students that met or exceeded state reading standards. Math scores reached a record high, more than 70% meeting or exceeding state standards. He brought together education reformers, teachers, local business leaders, launched an aggressive education reform program that included opening 100 new schools and many other programs, from after school and summer learning programs to closing down underperforming schools. He increased graduation rates. He boosted college scholarships and brought national attention to the Chicago system. Part of his background in college, he was the co-captain of the Harvard basketball team and was an academic All-American. He is married and has two children, age 7 and age 4. So, Mr. Secretary, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Yesterday, and many of you were there when you heard Eric Schmidt, the founder of Google, say that 95% of the best universities in the world are in the United States of America. And then we look at what happens from K through 12, where we spend more per capita on our students, and yet they run at the bottom of the heap of other developing countries in both math and science and in other programs. Mr. Secretary, I would know you have launched an ambitious program here, but I would just, before we talk about that, and that's certainly what we're going to talk about, I'd like for you to give me your idea of how did our educational system get into the mess it's in today.
I think as a country we lost our way. I mean, you go back a couple decades, we used to lead the world in the percent of college graduates. We were the envy of the world, and I think we got a little complacent. And it isn't so much that we've dropped, we've sort of flatlined. And lots of other countries have invested, have seen this as the way to drive change and drive improvement in their countries and their economy. And they've outworked us, they've out-invested in us, and we have to play catch-up now.
All right, so you have launched a program, and I must say, you're starting with something of an advantage that other secretaries of education have not, and that is in the stimulus bill that's already been passed by the Congress, there is $100 billion for education. You've been given basically $100 billion and told to make our educational system better. So where do you start and how are you going to do it?
It is a huge opportunity, a historic opportunity. Basically doubled our budget overnight. That doesn't happen too often anywhere in private sector or in the public sector. We're looking at every part of the education continuum, $5 billion for early childhood education. And you make a pretty good case that's the best money we can spend, the best investment. If we can get our 3- and 4-year-olds into kindergarten ready to learn and ready to read, they're going to do well. We have children entering kindergarten who don't know the front of a book from the back of a book. It makes it very, very hard for the best of kindergarten teachers. So massive investment there. K-12, $70 billion. One, to try and save hundreds of thousands of teaching jobs, and due to the horrendous economy, we are worried about an education catastrophe in the country, and we're going to be able to stave that off largely. But we can't just invest in the status quo. That's not going to get us where we need to go. And so we're going to push a very, very strong reform agenda, which we can get into on the K-12 side. We have to get dramatically better. And then the higher ed side, north of $30 billion to increase access and opportunity. And that, to me, is hugely important at a time when going to college has never been more important. It's never been more expensive, and families have never been under more financial duress. So it is an unbelievable opportunity to transform what's going on at every level. Some folks have said that the president and I are too ambitious or it's too broad an agenda, but we're convinced you have to work at every level, early childhood, K-12, higher ed. That's the only way we're going to get where we need to go as a country.
You're going to, tomorrow in San Diego, speak to the NEA. What are you going to tell them?
We're going to have an interesting conversation. And to me, it's so important that all of us, the unions, principals, us as the Department of Education, we all have to change our behavior. We're all part of the problem, and we have to get dramatically better. We have to be willing to challenge the status quo. We have to behave in very different ways of each other, and we have to move outside our comfort zone. I think in education, we've been scared to recognize excellence. I don't know why that is. We've been scared to put a spotlight, to reward, to incent, to recognize excellence. I think we have to do a better job of that. I think we have to be more honest when teachers aren't working to keep them in the profession for 25 or 30 years. That doesn't make sense either. So there's a range of things that we need to do collectively, and we all have to behave very, very differently to get where we need to go.
Are they going to like this speech?
Not everybody.
But you're ready for that.
We're challenging everybody, including ourselves.
You have talked about standards. You're not really a fan of No Child Left Behind in its current form. Just talk about where you think standards ought to be. Well, are they high enough, or are they too high?
Well, let me even start one step before that. The one thing I will always give the previous administration great credit for is really shining a spotlight on the achievement gap, this idea of disaggregating data and talking about the horrendous disparities in outcomes between white children and African-American and Latino children. As a country, we used to sweep that achievement gap under the rug. It was uncomfortable to talk about. And the focus on disaggregating data, the focus on closing that achievement gap is hugely important. We're never going to walk away from that. What No Child Left Behind, I think, got fundamentally wrong on the standards side is it allowed 50 states to do their own thing. So 50 states, 50 different goalposts, 50 different bars, and the vast majority, the overwhelming majority, not surprisingly, got dummied down due to political pressure. And in many states, including the state that I'm from, Illinois, I actually think we're lying to children. And let me explain why I say that. If a child or a parent is told that they are, quote unquote, meeting this standard, the logical assumption is that they're going to do okay, that they're on track to be successful. But in far too many places around the country, children that are, quote unquote, meeting a standard are barely able to graduate from high school and are totally inadequately prepared to go to a competitive university, let alone graduate. So that has to change. We have to talk about college-ready, career-ready, common, internationally benchmarked standards. And this is really an idea. It used to be the third rail, but it's an idea whose time has come. The unions are on board with this. The business community has been begging for this for a long time. We've had 46 states literally sign on the dotted line and commit to working on this together. The state school chiefs are working on this. So you have government, you have business, you have the unions, the private sector. Everyone's saying what we're doing isn't good enough for children. We have to stop lying. We have to stop dumbing things down. Let's raise the bar and hold ourselves accountable for getting there.
So how will you do this, though? Why, are you going to propose new legislation? Where do you go from here?
Well, I think where this dies is if this is federal standards, it dies. If this is national, this is being led at the local level. This is being led by great governors and great school chiefs. And we're, you know, sometimes you lead from the front, sometimes you cheerlead from the sidelines. And I'm waving the pom-poms on this one. This is really being led at the state, at the local level, which is where it needs to come from. And so we're going to continue to support it. We're going to use part of the race to the top money, $5 billion. We're going to use $350 million to help create great assessments behind these standards. But this is being driven by people who understand what they're doing in their states for children is not good enough educationally and is not good long-term economically. Leadership has to come at the local level on this
but
push.
But you're prepared to go in and pressure them into doing this. I mean, there will be carrots and sticks here, won't there?
We're encouraging them, absolutely.
Yeah. But how? I mean, to make that meaningful, how will you do that?
Well, we have, on top of the $100 billion, we have $5 billion in discretionary resources. And this is, again, extraordinary. I think I talked to Secretary Page. I think he had 17 million. We have 5 billion. And we're calling this the Race to the Top Fund. And we're going to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in states that are willing to lead the country where we need to go. And there's a series of reform items that we can walk through that if states are willing to commit to those, we want to partner with them. And so we have significant carrots on the table, unprecedented carrots, to work with states that want to break with the status quo and take the country where I'm convinced we have to go.
Are there sticks?
There are things that we can do to push on the downside, yeah.
You closed schools that weren't good schools in Chicago. Is that part of your plan? I mean, I'd like to talk to you about some of these turnarounds and how you did that.
Yeah, in big picture, we have about 95,000 schools in the country, call it 100,000. Top schools in the country are the best in the world. We can be absolutely proud. We should be replicating, learning from them, you know, doing everything we can to share those best practices. We have a set of schools in the middle that aren't where they need to be, but they're improving every year. We need to continue to encourage that and help those teachers continue to improve. But what we're trying to push the country to think about is, let's not think about the 99%. Let's think about the 1% at the bottom. Let's take 1,000 schools a year. These are schools that are dropout factories, where 60, 65, 70% of students are dropping out each year. These are schools where not just absolute test scores are low, but I'm a big believer in looking at gain and growth and where that growth is going worse, so students are falling further and further behind. And I'm just convinced that when those situations happen, we as educators, we actually start to perpetuate poverty and we start to perpetuate social failure. So about 6 years ago in Chicago, we closed 3 schools for academic failure. And it was probably the hardest thing we ever did and about killed us. We came back, same children, same buildings, same socioeconomic challenges, same communities, different adults, different expectations, different belief of what's possible. One of those schools in about the 3rd year of the turnaround became the highest performing, highest growth school in the state. Places where students are barely achieving are performing 2 or 3 times better. So I know what's possible. Doesn't matter how poor children are, doesn't matter how dysfunctional the families, and we give them real opportunities, real long-term support, have the highest of expectations, students can do well. So I'm trying to take the lessons we learned there, and we went from closing 3 to closing to 20, 25 a year and opening new schools every single year. There's some places you can improve. There's some places you just have to start fresh. Investing more in a dysfunctional situation, more money is not going to get us where we need to go.
Well, in some of those you talked about, you moved everybody out, right?
Yes.
I mean, all the teachers, the faculty, the administrators. And how do you do that? I mean, that sounds good. Okay, let's get rid of all the bad teachers, but it's a little harder than that, isn't it?
Well, and to be clear, I never blamed anyone. I said, if you want to blame anyone, blame me. And let me be clear, in every failing, dysfunctional school, there are some good teachers. There are some great teachers. There simply isn't enough. There isn't a large enough critical mass. And so there are phenomenal teachers who want this kind of challenge, who want to come into the toughest communities, who want to make a difference, who want to build a culture from the ground up. And we need to continue to recruit more great teachers, more great principals who are willing to do the toughest work in education today, which is turning around failing schools. But when we do it, and we do it with a real sense of urgency, we can dramatically change the outcomes for children and change their life chances forever.
Let's talk a little bit about this whole idea of teachers. I was very struck when you spoke at the National Press Club, and you said at one point in your speech, there is a lot of data about the average child with 3 great teachers in a row who will be a year and a half or 2 years ahead of where they should be. On the other hand, an average child who gets 3 poor performing teachers in a row will be so far behind they will never catch up.
In education, talent matters tremendously. Great teachers, great principals make a huge difference in our students' lives. They, to me, are the unsung heroes in our country. They're performing literally miracles every single day. The flip side of it, where it's not working, where you have teachers or principals that don't believe, don't believe what students can do, they become part of the problem. And so as an industry, as a field, we have been scared to recognize excellence, to reward excellence. That has to change. We have not been creative enough about not just identifying that great talent, but creating the incentives and the opportunities so that great talent will go to historically underserved communities, urban and rural, inner city, urban and rural. I also think there are areas, we're short math and science teachers. We've been short math and science teachers for 3 decades. I think we should pay math and science teachers more money. Why wouldn't, let's stop talking about it. Let's figure out how to do something differently. So thinking very differently about talent, identifying the best and brightest, recognizing, rewarding it, creating incentives so the best and brightest will go where we need them most. We talk so much about the achievement gap. There is a real achievement gap. I really see it as an opportunity gap. And the children that need the most help, that need the best teachers, traditionally get the worst. That has to change if we expect outcomes to change.
So you're obviously for merit pay. You're for paying teachers that teach in the tough schools more than maybe the teachers. But there's considerable opposition to that from the unions and other places.
Yes and no.
How do you meet that?
I'll tell you how you overcome it. First of all, you do this not to teachers, but with teachers. We created a performance-based program in Chicago. We have 25,000 teachers, 25 of the best, 1 out of 1,000 were an advisory council for me. They created a program, and they did it much better than anything I could have done. And so you include teachers from the front end in shaping this. And it's also really important. These programs fail when you pit teachers against each other. When you have teachers down the hallway where only one can win, the other 2 lose. I'm a big believer we have to deprivatize education. We have to open it up, get people to collaborate. And we created a program led by the teachers where, based upon student growth, every adult in the building benefited, not just the teachers, but the principal, the custodians, the security guards, the lunchroom attendants. And where you see high-performing schools that are beating the odds, it is always the culture of the building, every adult in the building pushing to be successful. So the devil's always in the details, but if you have teachers help design and create this, and shaping the program, and if you're doing it so that you're building a sense of collaboration and teamwork, which is so important to me, not pitting people against each other, this thing can work. And what was interesting, it was the best teachers in the system. I said, we could work on anything of school year. You help us get better. You help me get better. What do you want to work on? Unanimously, they want to work on how do you reward excellence. That's what the best teachers are looking for.
Talk a little bit about your program called Race to the Top, where states and school districts are going to compete later this year for a piece of this $5 billion fund to reward those who adopt innovations that you're pushing.
Yeah. This is, again, unprecedented discretionary resources. $4.35 billion for states and $650 million we're taking off to go directly to districts and nonprofits. And what we want to do is invest, again, real money, hundreds of millions of dollars, in states that are willing to commit to a series of four reforms. First, they have to commit to common, college-ready, career-ready, internationally benchmarked standards. They have to be willing to raise the bar and work together to do that. Secondly, they have to commit to having comprehensive data systems. It's been fascinating. I didn't realize we have states literally that have laws that prohibit the linking of students to teachers.
Now, what I read that in some of the research. What do you mean by that?
We have law. I'll say it again.
But I mean, that prevent them from linking in what way?
I think great teaching matters. I want to be able to identify those teachers and those schools that are making the biggest difference in students' lives based upon how much students are learning and growing. You have states that prohibit the linking of data systems between teachers and students. To me, this is the foundation of understanding what we do. Not to pick on them, I'm going there tomorrow, but California has 300,000 teachers. California has a great student information system and a great teacher information system. And I went out to California, I kept being told we have this firewall protecting these things, you know, these two systems can't talk. And I said firewalls are supposed to protect children, make them safe. This firewall is destroying our system. You have 300,000 teachers in California. The top 10%, the top 30,000 would be amongst the best in the world. The bottom 10%, the bottom 30,000 shouldn't be teaching. And no one in California can tell you who's in what category. Something's wrong with that picture. And so you have to be willing to look at student achievement, look at how teachers are contributing to student achievement, and then track teachers back to their schools of education so you know which schools of education are producing the teachers that are producing the students that are learning the most. Third, you have to think very differently about talent. We talked about that, how you recruit the best and brightest, how you keep them in education, how you incent them to take on tough assignments. And fourth, you have to be willing to close and turn around struggling schools. And so states that are willing to commit to that package of reforms, we want to partner with them in an unprecedented way. States that aren't willing to do that will simply miss out.
How do you measure whether somebody is a great teacher? I mean, because somebody would say, well, if you just teach to a test, and then the kids pass the test, but is that the test? Is that
no?
How you
I think
it?
You have to have multiple measures. Again, it can't just be one test, but student achievement has to be part of what you're looking at. And again, there's too many places that's been prohibited. So you look at student achievement, you look at teacher leadership and development, you look at what they're doing to contribute to the overall culture of the school, and again, you look at teams of teachers, entire schools that are beating the odds every single day. How do you recognize and reward that? And again, we haven't had the courage to have those honest conversations, and that has to change.
Talk a little bit about charter schools. I know you've had some fairly pointed remarks about charter schools. Some in the beginning thought maybe you were against charter schools, but that's not how you feel.
No, not at all. We had many charter schools in Chicago. I'm a fan not of charter schools. I'm a fan of good charter schools. Mm-hmm. And this is not let a thousand flowers bloom. To have successful charter schools, and we didn't do everything right. This is one area, honestly, we're in Chicago. I think we got the structure just about right. You need three things that have to happen. You have to have a very high bar to entry. This cannot be anyone with an education idea comes to teach. The chance to open a school is like a sacred obligation. And we approved many, but we turned away many more than we actually approved. And so a very high bar to entry. Once you pick the best of the best, these are, by definition, these are education entrepreneurs. They're innovators. You have to free them from bureaucracy. You have to get the bureaucracy off their back and give them the autonomy to drive that vision. Third, you have to hold them accountable for results. And we had 5-year performance contracts. I love charter schools, but I closed 3 for low performance. Mm-hmm. And I think that combination of real autonomy and real accountability is very, very important. And so I'm challenging the charter community to continue to scale up. And we have some of the highest performing schools around the country happen to be charter schools today. We need many more of those. But I'm also challenging the charter school community not to tolerate third-rate charters. That really endangers a movement that I think has profound significance in our country. And so let's reward excellence, let's scale it up, let's replicate it, let's learn from it. But where charters aren't working, let's deal with that openly and honestly as well.
We want to go to some questions from you all out in the audience, so be thinking your questions now, and I'll sort of wrap up my questions while you all are beginning to think of them. I must say that when I came over here and I peeked in, you were having a meeting with the Bezos scholars here, and I thought it was very interesting because you were asking them questions and asking them what advice they had for you. Did you get any good ideas?
I got some great ideas. I don't know if they're in here now. It's an unbelievably smart group of students. They're way ahead of where I was in high school, I'll tell you. And no, it was an amazing conversation. Great teachers, great students. And a big part of my job, again, we don't need the great ideas are never going to come from Washington. Great ideas are always going to come at the local level. And a big part of my job is simply to listen and to learn what's working, what's not, and take to scale. And students had some phenomenal ideas. And a couple of them I'm going to keep working with me going forward.
What's been the hardest part so far in this job?
I'm loving it. It's unbelievable. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a big country I'm learning, and California is like its own country. California's been a challenge, so trying to figure that one out. But to have the chance, all you want in life is to have a chance to make a difference, and to have a chance to make a difference at this scale, I pinch myself some days. It's absolutely amazing.
What do you think is going to be, well, you're already launched. You've launched these programs and stuff, but where is your priority right now in what you're trying to push and what you're trying to get done?
Well, I'm a big believer in looking at outcomes. At the end of the day, the president's drawn a line in the sand. The president said we need to again lead the world in the percent of college graduates by 2020, and we used to be there. And we've, in the past, you know, two and a half decades, we've lost our way. And so everything we do, early childhood, K to 12, has to lead to more students who can be successful and go to a college, 4-year, 2-year, whatever it might be, and graduate. At the end of the day, we need to produce students that are much more capable academically, and everything has to lead to that ultimate outcome.
You're talking about programs for children before they go to school, the early childhood programs, but you're also, and I think a lot of people were surprised, you're also putting an emphasis on higher education here, not just to get kids to college, but to get them to graduate. Talk about those programs.
Yeah, well, again, just going to college is so critically important today. And you guys know, there aren't any good jobs out there for just high school graduates. It's not enough anymore. So we have to increase access and make college more affordable. And there's been a huge push there. But we have to really increase attainment as well. And it's interesting. Colleges are not unlike high schools. We have some colleges that do a great job of working with students who might be first generation going to college or coming from disadvantaged backgrounds or learning English. You have other colleges that don't do such a great job there. So part of our FY10 budget is actually $2.5 billion to really focus $500 million a year over 5 years to focus not on college entry, but on college completion. And you want to do more to make sure students are graduating. We've done some things recently, starting now, to reduce debt for students that are going into the public sector or non-for-profits so that folks aren't burdened with huge debt and can't pursue their dreams. We need this next generation of great teachers. So there's lots of room for us to be creative, to increase access, to increase attainment, and to make sure we're rewarding students who do the right thing and can come out and chase their dreams rather than some profession they need to do just to pay back $200,000 in student loans.
You know, I mean, this is kind of a weird question, but there was a little red schoolhouse that was built at the entrance of the Department of Education. I believe it was put there by Secretary Page during the Bush administration. You tore it down.
We took it down.
Why?
We put up pictures of children around the building. And so it's not about the buildings, it's about children.
And so that was symbolic. I mean, you did this for...
It was symbolic.
Yeah. All right. Let's have some questions. I see there seem to be microphones there.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for coming. I'm Mark Oren from Miami and from Aspen. I'd like you to, there is not a single thing you said that I disagree with, but I would like you to
elaborate. I should shut up now. I'll go home.
But I would like you to elaborate, if you would, on how we know how we're doing. Let me give you a couple of examples. Test taking is a skill in itself. In other words, there are some people who are very bright who are not very good exam takers. In Florida, we have the anomalous situation of teaching for the test. Kids are not allowed to go on field trips for 3 months a year because they are being crammed for the evaluation test. Uh, the, the amount of art, music, physical education in our schools is dropping dramatically. That is not to denigrate the importance and value of science and math and English and all those other things. But I think that the present evaluation system is very faulty, and I wonder if you could elaborate on that a bit.
It's a great question. This is a much longer topic, but this is actually one of the biggest things that the students and the teachers talked about an hour earlier, and I worry a lot about it. What you're really referring to is the narrowing of the curriculum. And I worry a lot about art and music and dance and drama and chess and PE being lost. And it's so important to me that children, particularly from disadvantaged communities, have those kinds of opportunities early in life. And our children have to be able to develop their skills, their passion, their sense of self-esteem. And it's something we need to really think about as we go into NCLB reauthorization, is how we get away from the narrowing of the curriculum and really encourage schools to provide this broad-based education that at the end of the day, if we're serious about reducing a 30% dropout rate that is unacceptable, often it's the after-school program that keeps children in school, not just what's going on during the school day. So it's one without easy answers, but I'm very, very aware of. I think it's a real concern, it's a real issue, and we need to find ways to flip that as we go forward.
Miss it, Mike.
My name's Marianne Peoples, and you've talked a lot. I agree with everything you've said. I'm a former high school teacher a long time ago. But I haven't heard anything, you didn't say anything about technical and vocational training, how that sort of falls into, you know, your goals, because for every child, college isn't really the best place for them to be.
It's a great point. When I always say common, college-ready, career-ready, internationally benchmark standards. And to me, it's really a false choice. I agree. I think this is another place we've sort of lost our way as a country. I think voc ed in our country in the 50s and 60s was much better than it is today. What I want to do is I want all of our students to have a range of options. I think people think it's either a college track or a career track. Those tracks are actually very, very similar. As you know, most students today are both going to college and working at the same time. And so I would argue as a country, we're not doing enough of either preparing students for careers in the world of work or for college. And we got to do much better on both sides of that. And thinking about technical and vocational training is very, very important.
On this side.
Diana Serco from Aspen. I just have a question about public school, and I guess as a 35-year public school person, and we know that until 100% of our students are successful across the country, our job's not done. But my question would be, how can we also highlight and celebrate some of the successes of public schools across our country? We know we build from our strengths, so how can we continue to reward those schools that start high and stay high?
Yeah, that to me is a huge part of my job. Is, as you said, in every, you know, urban, rural, suburban, we have extraordinary schools that year after year after year are beating the odds and doing wonderful things for children. So I don't need to come up with any great ideas. My job is to listen, to find those best practices, and to scale them up. And all this discretionary money we have, all I want to do is invest in those schools, those school districts, those nonprofits that are both closing the achievement gap and raising the bar for everybody. So we have an unprecedented opportunity to do that and to take to scale what works. There's a program, you guys are going to watch a movie tonight, the NIFTY program, this 1098 movie that focuses on the, you know, this idea of teaching entrepreneurship. Well, they're doing a phenomenal job. We should have more students engage in that. I'm a big fan of Teach for America. They're doing a great job producing the next generation of teachers. We should invest more in that. And so my job is, again, not to come up with the next great idea. My job is to find out what's really working around the country and help those folks take to scale those best practices. It's a unique, unique opportunity.
Over here.
I'm Dan Sharp with the Institute for Large-Scale Innovation. I'd like to ask you to comment on a recent quotation of Tom Friedman's. He said the stimulus program will help our economy recover, but only innovation will help us retain our competitiveness. You're bringing great innovation to the process of education. What changes are you doing in education to enhance the ability of our students to be innovative?
That's a great question. I think so much of that is providing students with a range of opportunities to pursue their skills and pursue their passions. And so again, just an example you guys are watching tonight, this NIFTY program is taking children from some very, very tough backgrounds and giving them a chance to be entrepreneurs, to be innovators, to build their own businesses. There's a young man, I don't know if he's here, who's in the movie, Rodney Walker. There he is, coming up next. I don't want to start crying up here, but this young man has overcome some things that most of us would think is just unimaginable. And because he had those opportunities, he was on the dean's list this year, freshman at Morehouse, class president, very, very tough background. Never seen a mountain before he came here today. never seen a mountain. So we have to find more opportunities to help students find their passion, find their creativity, give them the ability to innovate, and despite tough situations, they can do great things.
Over here.
Hi, my name is Kathy Albisa. Thank you for the amazing leadership you've brought to the department. I really appreciate you mentioning the importance of the culture of the entire school. And I know that in Chicago, they had sort of rejected a zero tolerance approach, and that the department's been very supportive of alternatives to zero tolerance, which really degrade the culture and criminalize the schools. But in Chicago, for example, where they've rejected it, we know it's still happening. So I would just love to hear your thoughts, or if they're not your ideas, other ideas you've heard, on how we actually shift the culture now that policies are starting to reject zero tolerance and support positive behavior and restorative justice practices.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a complicated one. Let me be clear. If students are bringing a weapon to school, you know, bringing quantities of drugs to schools, I think they need to be expelled. But they need to be put, not expelled to the streets, but put in an alternative school where you never give up on a child and give that student a chance to be successful. What happened too much, it was fascinating, in Chicago, is we, for minor situations, we were arresting kids. We were arresting students. And perpetuating them, putting them in the criminal justice system, not surprisingly, largely young, male, African-American, Latinos. And we did some work, and it was fascinating. 53% of the arrests that we were arresting kids were coming from 7% of our schools. Think about that. We were part of the problem. And I go back to leadership. It takes great principals to take that child who's struggling a little bit, not call the police, but work with a family, work with a counselor, work with a social worker, work with a case manager, work with a teacher to help that child be successful. So we have to decriminalize this. You have to empower students through peer juries and, you know, PBIS and other programs to be part of the solution. And we didn't solve this thing. I'm, you know, still a long way to go. So you need a clear bottom line. You need clear alternatives for students where it's simply not working in the mainstream setting. But you have to go that extra mile for children that are just really crying out for help and need that support.
Thank you.
Bunty Bora. So I'm not in the education space. I have lots of teachers that can testify to that fact. And I'm not opinionated on this question either. It's a little bit of an extension of the first question. And so I'm just looking for your thoughts. And, you know, given your next questioner, you know, indulge yourself that you have an easy judge here. If you think about the narrowing of the curriculum as one problem, you know, is there also potentially an argument for thinking about expanding beyond even what we think is expansive? I mean, we have problems related to, you know, basic financial literacy, you know, nutrition, you know, even, you know, I heard today, you know, basic civic, you know, not just fine arts, not the things that were in the curriculum that are being peeled out, but things that we've never thought about as being part of the formal education infrastructure.
I think
that's a lot of money that you guys have. Is there a thought process around it?
Yeah, I think we have to do those things. I'll tell you, I started at a small, before I joined the Board of Education in 1995, I started a small public school from the outside in Chicago. The whole focus of the curriculum was financial literacy. It was funded by Aero Capital Management, John Rogers, who's you know, part of the Henry Crown program as well. And from kindergarten on, we were teaching kids about financial literacy. In sixth grade, they were investing real money in the stock market. And not surprisingly, these students' math scores are off the charts. It's one of the highest performing public elementary schools in the city in a desperately poor neighborhood. And so to me, it's not like an either or. We have to do those things. We have to go the extra mile. We have to get engaged in a number of things that we haven't been doing as educators historically. And that's the only way we're going to get where we need to go.
Thank you.
Over here.
Stephen Breyer. I'm really just speaking to you. I'm not going to have a chance to see you. And so I thought this is my best opportunity. So I'd like a thought just for you, and I think they're listening, but in the back of your mind. This is the thought. Sandra and O'Connor and I were sitting where you are now an hour ago, and we were talking about civics education, and there's nothing we think more important than that. And she does a lot, and we do other things. And so this is not saying anything about a case. You have no advantage insofar as you have a case. But it is saying something about things we do outside of that. And as the thought I want in your mind is just that we're resources for you. And it's not just the two of us, it's others in the building too. So I'd like you to remember it in case it becomes
real. Thank you so
much.
I was lucky enough to have lunch with Sandra Day O'Connor a little while ago. I love the work that you guys are doing and want to find ways to continue to partner. It's really, really important. Thank you.
Over here.
First, I'd like to say thank you for coming, Mr. Secretary. My name is Spencer Casimir. Grew up in New York and now live in California. Thank you. I'll go sit down now. But honestly, I mean, this is a place for tough questions, tough answers, hopefully. What do you attribute the decline, really, of our school system to? I was at a meeting with Governor Schwarzenegger and Mayor Bloomberg, and one said, well, there's no actual correlation between larger class sizes and poor performance that have ever been proven. And afterwards, I started looking it up, and there's a slew of different reasons that people give or say are not the reasons. I actually came across a funny one saying that it's women's fault, because when they started going into the workforce, all these overqualified teachers left teaching. There's so much out there, and I want to know what you attribute to the decline and how we can prevent it from ever happening again.
To me, again, there are a million reasons why we are where we are. To me, it's less, people could write 10 PhDs or 100 PhDs on that. I'm more interested in figuring out where we need to go, and I'll tell you what matters. Mm-hmm. Great talent matters, how we think about talent. High expectations matter. Being honest about rewarding excellence matters. Being honest about where things aren't working, doing things differently matter. And I think if we do those things, to me, this is not an intellectual challenge. Mm-hmm. What we have lacked as a country is courage. We have lacked political will. And so the challenge before us is less about the next great breakthrough. The question is, can we do what we know is right for children? Do we as a country have the political courage and the will to do the right thing for children? And if we do that, we will fundamentally break through. And if we don't, we will continue to be mired in mediocrity.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And I hope you get that fixed in California.
Thank you.
All right, Rod.
Marty, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Glad to see you, let me tell you.
I have a question. Well, as a loyal student of Chicago Public Schools, I have a great passion for it, but what I do know is that there are resources in Chicago Public Schools, I know, but a lot of students are not exposed to it, and what I do know also is that 80% of the students in Chicago Public Schools are from impoverished and low-income communities. I heard you speak a lot about bringing effort to the educational system to make sure that you all do the best that you can to put emphasis on students and how they're going to be learning in school and making sure that they succeed, but how do you plan to incorporate the parents and how they also coordinate with education systems to make sure that they work efficiently and become more oriented around education and making sure that they get their kids in school and things like that?
Great question. Before I begin, please give this guy a huge round of applause. This is it's the Rodneys of the world that inspire me and make me so happy to feel so lucky I have the chance to do this work. Parents are a huge part of the equation. And to me, it's always easy to sort of point fingers and talk about lack of parental engagement. So let me take a minute on this. Before I do that, I think it's really important to be self-critical and look in the mirror. And I think we as educators have done a lot to discourage parental involvement. We tell them to drop the kids off at the door and not participate, not be engaged. I think schools need to be open 12, 13, 14 hours a day. I think schools have to be community centers. I think schools have to work with children during this, after school. I talked about GED, ESL, family literacy nights, family counseling, healthcare clinics, potluck dinners, food helps. And I could take you to schools in the heart of the South and West Side of Chicago where you have 100 to 150 parents coming to school every day, not for their children's education, but for their own. And when families are learning together, children do great, great things. And so I think before we point fingers, there's a lot we can do to open up our doors and create a climate where parents are engaged and welcome. And you have to remember, many of our public school parents, particularly coming from poor families, why are the families poor? Because the parents weren't educated. The parents had failure experiences in school. So you're fighting a lifetime where school didn't work for them and then trying to re-engage them. You have to go the extra mile. You have to go knock on their doors. You have to be out there. If you just sit back and wait for them to show up, it's not going to happen. But great principals, great teachers, have that work. So I actually equate parents back to where I started with schools. I think that's going to work for 99.something% of parents. I will also say that there's a small percent of families that home is so tough, so dysfunctional, crack addiction, parents locked up, abuse. There's a small percent of families where we need to think about boarding schools. We need to think about having our children 24/7, where what we do 12 or 14 hours a day isn't enough. And it was interesting. I went to college out east, and I'd never heard of a boarding school. And all of a sudden, I had roommates and people in my dorm. All these people had gone to boarding schools.
And I always think in our country, if it's good enough for wealthy families, it's probably good enough for poor families too. And so I think we need to be a little bit more thoughtful, a little bit more creative. Let's engage the vast majority of parents in a very different way, but where it's simply not working, if we're serious about helping students be successful, there's some students I think we need to have with us 24/7.
Secretary Duncan, my name is Steve Zwolak. I'm with University City Children's Center in St. Louis, Missouri. I've had the opportunity to visit several of the quality programs in the Chicago area, and want to acknowledge you for putting threes and fours in early childhood as a priority for our country. Some of the success that Chicago has had was directly related to 0-3 work, the doula programs that they've done. What initiatives are you going to put forth for 0-3, particularly since 85% of a child's brain is developed by 0-3?
So. Part of what we're using the stimulus, the $5 billion for, is to try and hire 55,000 healthcare nurses to go out and do home visits on that 0-3 age. So we really want to get people out on the streets, engaging families, particularly in at-risk communities, to make sure we're starting to get those basic socialization and literacy skills intact before children get to us at 4 or 5. So we have to get people out in the homes working with families.
Thank you.
Okay. This side?
Joan Harris from Chicago. At the risk of being redundant, I would like you to talk, if you would, talk a little bit more about the early childhood piece of the stimulus package. I never thought in my life I would think that $5 billion wasn't enough. So if you could, following on the previous question, if you could add just a little bit, tell us a little bit more about all the pieces of the early childhood.
Sure, and it's never enough, and so it's not enough. And again, I appreciate so much what you and your family have done, and it's just it was a huge inspiration to me back home. But to me, it's about two things. It's about access, and we have so many students, young children, again, particularly from disadvantaged communities, that don't have access to early childhood programs. But secondly, it's about quality. And if this is glorified babysitting, it's not going to get us where we need to go. So if we can dramatically increase access, but increase access to high-quality programs, again, I think this is probably the best investment we can make. So those are the two areas where we're going to spend all of our time, energy, and resources.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Hunkler, formerly from Chicago, here now here in Aspen. And my question is about, really, the short-term financial situation. One of the things that came up in a session the other day is that with all these funds going to the states at a time when they're in severe financial crisis, that a lot of state legislatures are turning around and taking funding you're giving them and just taking it out of education budgets so they can use it elsewhere to fill their budget holes. What levers do you have, and are you going about dealing with that so that the money you're sending out to fund all these wonderful things actually is additive?
Yeah, it's a great question, and there's some inherent tension here. Again, we talked about as many as 600,000 teaching jobs, education jobs going away. So we didn't want to see class size go from 25 to 40. We didn't want to see librarians and social workers and counselors laid off. And so part of the stimulus money, a large piece of it, is going to save literally hundreds of thousands of jobs. But as I said before, if all we do is invest in the status quo and if states play shell games, that's not going to get us where we need to go. So we have both carrots and sticks, to go back to your original question. So we put out billions of dollars, but we withheld billions of dollars, which other folks didn't do. And the second set of the stimulus money, we're putting out based upon states acting in good faith. And if states are acting in bad faith, or not doing the right thing, or not acting in the spirit of what's right for children, we absolutely have the ability to withhold that money. And I'm not looking for a fight, I'm not looking to go to war, but if we're not feeling it, we're gonna do that. And you may have seen, we've been very, very proactive with states, letting them know early on when we think they're moving in the right direction. And when they're not. And so far, generally, states have been pretty responsive. The second thing is, that's sort of on the stick side. The second thing is, again, we have unprecedented carrots, $5 billion. And what we have said repeatedly is the first question on the race to the top application is, what have you done in an innovative, creative way with your stimulus dollars? If the states don't have a good answer, they might as well tear the application up. They're not going to be in the running. So we tried to put very significant sticks as well as an unprecedented carrot out there. And this is a real test of leadership. These times are absolutely dire. And it's interesting to see some folks are going to be paralyzed by this, by this time and by the stress and the real pressure you're under. But I'm a real believer. Rahm Emanuel, the President's Chief of Staff, has this great line, "Never waste a good crisis." And I often think a time of crisis is the only time you can sort of get breakthrough reform and change. And you're actually seeing in other states unbelievable creativity and innovation that honestly would not have happened were it not for this crisis we're in. So this is a real test of leadership at every level. And if folks can handle it, we're going to really reward them. If folks can't handle it, they're going to do their children a great disservice in their state.
Great, thank you.
Over here.
Hey there, Kirsten Lodl. I want to better understand kind of how you see charter schools, great charter schools, as laboratories for innovation that then somehow get mainstreamed into the public school system and how porous that relationship is, because it seems like no matter how much we replicate charter schools, it's still a subscale solution. I just don't know enough about how much those great practices of great schools are then being pushed into non-charter schools.
Yeah, so I think there are three things. When you have great charter schools, a couple things have to happen. You have to really start to go to scale, and what we're seeing now is not just one-off mom and pops, but you're seeing networks of very high-performing charter schools, 10, 20, 30, 40 schools, and we're early on in that evolution, but you can see those networks starting to go to 50, 70, 100 schools, sort of running mini school districts, so we need to continue to encourage that. I've been pushing very hard against states with charter caps. I think we need to get more charter school operators to get in the turnaround business we talked about earlier. We as a country don't have enough capacity yet collectively to turn around 1,000 schools a year that I'd like to do. So we want to challenge charter operators to think about that. And then you absolutely have to work on both sides, charters sharing with districts and districts being willing to listen to charters and vice versa. And let me be clear, it's not that charters have all the great ideas. Some districts have great stuff that would help their charters. And I think they have been a little bit isolated or islands. And so really cutting through that, and to me, it's part of creating good accountability systems for charters and charter networks, is what are you doing to share best practices? What are you doing to open your doors? And if we put the right, the right structures around that, we'll incent the right behavior that will encourage much more of that sharing. The final thing I'll say that there's some great innovation going on in the charter schools, but as I travel the country and, one of the just basic common things charter schools are doing, they just have more time. They're just working longer hours. They're working 9-10 hours a day, 6-7 days a week. Some of it is really innovative curriculum. Some of it, frankly, isn't. They're just outworking the traditional schools, and time matters. So just getting all of us to think very differently about 6-hour days, five days a week just doesn't make sense.
Over here.
Hi, Veronique Pittman from the Green Schools Alliance. What are you doing to engage schools in accelerating the greening of our nation? How are you empowering teachers, students, and parents to be agents for change by requiring schools as part of their science curriculum to measure and reduce their energy use, lowering their carbon footprint while saving taxpayers money and making science relevant to kids again?
A couple things. We have in the stimulus package significant money for schools on the capital side, and we've strongly put out guidance to talk about retrofitting and green energy and trying to make sure that we're making one-time investments that will save the right thing for the environment, will save schools lots of money going forward. Secondly, I'm a big fan of sort of service learning and really hands-on engaged curriculum. And the more we're, both at the middle school and the high school level, creating opportunities for students to get out of the classroom, get out into the environment, to be part of that, to be sort of hands-on in their learning. There are tremendous academic dividends for that. And we all talk about teaching for the test. Well, not surprisingly, great teachers and great students get good test results. So this is really the right way to do it. It's not more test prep. And so we have to continue to reward that and, again, shine a spotlight on those teachers and those schools that are doing a great job of actively engaging students. And that's going to lead us to the outcomes we want, both for the environment, but academically for our children as well.
On this side?
I hope that you won't hate me for this question.
I won't, I promise.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Livingston. I'm from Los Angeles, California. And as you probably know, our K through 12 education is in a state of paralysis. We have a school board that is protecting its turf, refusing to compromise. We have a bureaucracy that absolutely spends most of its time protecting themselves. And I am not personally an anti-union person. And I agree with you, the teaching is a gift. And I find that what the union is doing is protecting the weaker teachers. I understand that's part of what they do, that's part of their role. But in teaching, we can't afford it. What do you have as a possible beginning to change this structure?
So it's a great question. And I will say that I'm absolutely believe that both with the AFT and the NEA, the two national unions, we have more enlightened union leadership than we have had in a long, long time. And what they have said repeatedly to me is they want to get out of the business of protecting bad teachers, that it hurts the profession, that it hurts them long term, and you know, we want to have, you know, have make sure they have their rights and aren't being, you know, treated unfairly. But that has to fundamentally change. And so we talk about moving folks outside their comfort zone. That's part of what needs to happen there. And I'm going to work very, very hard with the unions to think about how we, as I talked about earlier, how we reward excellence, how we recognize that, how we support those teachers that are, you know, struggling but improving and getting better. But then at the bottom, how we have a much more honest and frank and candid conversation when it's simply not working. There's a recent study that came out from the New Teacher Project, a fascinating study that confirmed what you and I know, that in many, many school districts, 99% of teachers are all rated the same. They call it the Widget Report. And to me, that's the worst thing you can do for teachers. It doesn't recognize excellence, it doesn't support those in the middle, and it doesn't deal with failure. And we have to stop thinking about teachers as widgets. We have to think about them as highly trained, highly skilled professionals, and when they're doing a great job, we can't do enough to support them. When they're not doing a great job, we need to move them out. And so there's a lot of room that we have to work on collectively to fundamentally change how we evaluate, how we hire, how we think about tenure, how we think about real career ladders. And this is part of the change, this is part of the culture change that we need to go through. I will add a little bit more. To me, it's not just about the unions in LA. I'm a big believer, and particularly in big cities, we're seeing the issues now in New York are for mayoral control. And I'll tell you, I would never have had the opportunity that I have today, would never have had the opportunity had Mayor Daley not had the courage in 1995 to take control of Chicago Public Schools. That is hugely important. And as you well know, in large cities, in large school systems, these problems are so intractable, they are so difficult, that if it's just we as school systems trying to get better, we can't do it alone. You have to have the business community, you have to have the philanthropic community, you have to have the nonprofits, the religious, the social service agencies, you have to have all the other sister departments, the police, the fire, the children and youth services, and the only way you get that is by leadership at the top. And so what's going on in New York to me makes no sense now. By any measure, New York public schools have gotten better. We need to make sure Mayor Bloomberg has control and keep Chancellor Klein empowered. Chicago's gonna continue to progress long after I'm gone because the mayor's there and has great, great leadership. Detroit has been a disaster of a public school system, a national embarrassment, a disgrace for years. I'm lobbying very, very hard that has to change. And I put LA in the same category.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Matt Miller, Center for American Progress. We're the only advanced nation that tolerates such a huge inequity in per pupil spending between the typical high poverty district and the typical nearby affluent suburb, and that has a big impact on things like the quality of the teachers because teacher salaries are a big piece of the budget of the school. Is there any way to lift the bottom in America without revisiting the way we deal with our system of school finance, and what does that mean for what the federal contribution ought to be to school finance overall?
That's a great question. That's a big question. Quick context, I come from Illinois that was 49th out of 50 states in the amount of money going to education and 43rd in disparities between rich districts and poor districts. And districts that were 5 miles north of us, we were 90% minority and 85% poverty. They were, you know, literally white and rich. They received 2.5 times as much money as we did in Chicago. So again, we talk a lot about the achievement gap. I like to talk about the opportunity gap. I think as a country, we have not believed in our hearts that poor children could learn and be successful. And what has happened, part of why I'm hopeful now, is we have more examples around the country, inner city, urban, rural, of not individual children, not just the Rodney Walkers of the world making it, but of class after class, grade after grade, year after year, of students being successful. We have in the toughest communities, places where the graduation rate is 95%, and 90% of those who graduated going on to college. And so I think what we have to do is challenge the general American public to understand that this is not some miracle, that when we provide the resources, when we provide the investment, we do the right thing, children can be successful. Harlem Children's Zone, huge fan of what's going on there. It takes resources. It also takes real accountability. When those two things come together, children can routinely defy the odds. And so I think we have to continue to convince the American public that this investment is worth it. And I think we have to hold ourselves accountable for results. And when it's not working, to be willing to deal with failure. I think if we do those two things, we'll move the American public to see the great, huge injustices and huge inequities that exist.
All right, we have about 3 minutes left, so. We'll try to work in every question, but.
Okay, thanks. I'm Edith Harrell Caperton, president of the Worldwide Workshop Foundation in New York. And I'm very impressed with your vision today, $100 billion, 100,000 schools. Let's try to turn around 1,000 at a time. Not one at a time, 1,000 at a time, and then making school days longer and bringing parents to the school and getting students into math and science and recruiting and paying more for math and science teachers. However, as an education entrepreneur who's doing just that every day of my life and being passionate about it, I can tell you that when we go to some of the poor rural schools and we are in some of these places when we are turning them around, many of my colleagues even gave up on the public school system, but those of us who are there, we cannot get people to make games and build simulations for physics and mathematics and the climate. We cannot do robotics, compose music, bring parents, do workshops, because there is no computers for every student. There is no high-speed connectivity. And it's almost like so basic to even call for the innovation. So we probably shouldn't even elongate the school days or you know, bring parents to the school if the school is not an appropriate learning environment. So what are we going to put in front of the Department of Education instead of the little red schoolhouse?
Well, we got pictures of children. That's what we have. So
they're at the center.
But let me sort of get to your point. Again, it goes back to the earlier question about just sort of this basic fundamental set of resources, and that if schools don't have computer labs today, if they don't have connectivity, you know, what are we doing for our children? And so this is an issue we need to work on. I'll tell you, it's a bigger story, but there's this major E-rate program that's put billions of dollars out there to get schools wired and connected. That comes out of the FCC. The new FCC chairman is very interested in spreading this to communities that haven't been served. And so I think we have to commit as a country to make sure there's a foundation. I never want to take from the haves, but you have to bring up the bottom. You have to support the have-nots. And I think we have to commit as a country to make sure that there's a fundamental baseline of support, of infrastructure, of resources, a foundation that every child has access to. And we are clearly nowhere near that yet today.
When will we be near that?
We're pushing as hard as we can every single day.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Spence from Carbondale, Colorado. Mr. Secretary, what is your feeling about providing quality education K through the end of college for the children of undocumented residents? And also, is your department collaborating on the immigration reform initiatives?
Yeah, we have to, and this is one. I come from Chicago, where a third of our students were Latino and a very high percentage were undocumented. And for those students not to have the chance to go into college makes absolutely no sense to me. And if we want them to, again, you know, break cycles of poverty and be successful, for those students to work that hard, and some of them were literally valedictorians in our high schools, and then we denied the opportunity. So Senator Durbin and I worked very closely. I'm a big supporter of the DREAM Act. Just on a very small, my wife and I set up a small scholarship fund just to try and help some of these undocumented students at home because we saw a tremendous need. So I think as a country, we're absolutely backwards on this one now. We have to find ways to help students that are working hard go to college and be successful. And we want to be part of changing that.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end. Thank you so much, Mr. Secretary. Thank you all very much.